Lord, now we look to you to speak to us through your word, that by your grace this would be something that continues our worship of you as we interact with you, your nature, your mind, your will. Give us concentration, help us physically, but most of all help us in our mental and spiritual approach to this. We know that you will be glorified by the giving forth of your word. May it be in a way that leads to greater understanding of you and greater obedience by your grace. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. I have fond memories of my honeymoon. Allison and I were given a week of timeshare accommodations by her grandmother as a wedding present, and we chose to go to Abaco Island in the Bahamas. We were married on a Friday night and flew to Miami the next morning and then went on to this island. I remember our sense of relief that we were done with all of those wedding responsibilities, and I'm sure you can relate. We could get on with our lives as a married couple now. But as nice as it was to spend a week in that tropical setting, our trip was not without its mishaps and disappointments. We found that the people of the Bahamas were not overly careful about where they discard their unwanted furniture and appliances. Much of the landscape was not what you would call pristine. The weather was a bit rainy on a number of days, as could be expected in November. We had trouble finding restaurants that were open since it was the off-season there. At one establishment, despite a full and very delicious-sounding menu posted outside, about all that they actually had on hand was plain chicken and vanilla ice cream. And then there was our excursion to a small neighboring island called Guana Key. I did not say guano, okay? Guana Key. It was the prettiest day of our trip, actually, and as we went to one side of that key, we had a beach all to ourselves. Things were really looking up. Then we noticed a little path that led off through the lush vegetation to the other side of the island, and we decided that we would take that. We had not gone far, however, when we were attacked by a swarm of stinging insects. It was with great speed that we retreated back to the beach. I was not affected much, but Allison came away with several sizable welts with which to remember our romantic stroll on Guana Key. Well, as unsatisfactory as some of those experiences were, we had a dream honeymoon compared to Samson. His wedding celebration seemingly starts off on the right foot with feasting and games, but quickly the festivities degenerate into frustration, deception, ugly threats, betrayal, and rage. Forget about being the highlight of every woman's life. This is a bride's nightmare wedding. And then there's the culminating act of this whole affair. You know those commercials in which people who have just reached a high point in their lives proclaim, "I'm going to Disneyland," or "I'm going to Disney World." Samson's response to the question, what are you going to do now that you're married, would have been, I'm going to kill 30 people and take their clothes. Somehow that seems to mitigate the joy of the occasion. And what's more, Samson doesn't even leave the wedding with his wife. Now that is what I call a disappointing honeymoon. But as always, we find that God is overseeing all of these events to further His purposes. Let's get into the text now, beginning with verses 10 through 14. We've had those read for us. We learned last week from verse 8 that Samson had returned to the Philistine city of Timnah to claim his pagan bride. The period of betrothal had run its course, and it was time for this union to be consummated. On the way to the celebration, Samson had looked at the carcass of the lion that he had killed months previously. Finding honey in it, he ate some of that, and he brought a portion to his parents. But he said nothing about the honey's origin. And we talked about how some see this as an unwillingness to admit that he had broken his Nazirite vow, dealing with a dead body, and it was even connected to a vineyard and so forth. I think that there's a question as to whether he actually did. Regardless, it seems more likely in the light of subsequent events that a further use for this honey had already occurred to him. Apparently it was the custom for there to be a special feast for all of the young men of the town, in addition to the other wedding activities. This appears to be what we would call a bachelor party. Samson therefore makes preparations for one, but he had not brought any friends with him and probably was not all that close to anyone in the city. And so this feast had the potential to be a real dud. I've been to a couple of bachelor parties that never really seemed to get off the ground, and this looked like one that was going to bomb big time. But the bride's family saw what Samson was doing, and 30 companions were provided in order to celebrate with him. After all, Samson was marrying one of their own, and the Philistines were only too happy to see Jews intermarrying with them, hopefully resulting in a full accommodation to their ways. Some see a fear of Samson in assigning 30 men to this feast, as if it were a desire to keep a close watch on him. I suppose that's possible, but I see no reason to see anything at this point except a desire to follow custom and honor somebody at his wedding. We see that Samson was not shy in the presence of these Philistines, who perhaps were essentially strangers to him. Riddle games were quite common as entertainment in the ancient world, and they often had a wager riding on them. Samson has been working on the perfect conundrum ever since seeing that lion carcass on his way into town. So as soon as the appropriate moment arrives, Samson challenges all present to solve a riddle. The price of failure will be steep to the losing party. The clothes that he refers to were the expensive festal garments that the men would have been wearing. Samson was obviously very confident of winning this wager because he could hardly have had the resources to make good on his end of the bargain. The Philistines were eager to take him up on the offer. Surely 30 Philistines could not be outsmarted by one Jew. And so Samson springs the riddle, put into poetic form. Well, that confidence of the hearers gave way to frustration. as the hours and then days passed. The subject of the puzzle seemed to be a carnivore of some kind, okay, out of the eater. But how could such a beast provide something sweet to eat? It began to dawn on the Philistines that they were facing a humiliating and costly defeat to the new kid in town. In verse 15, we see how these men handle their inability to solve the riddle. Then it came about on the fourth day that they said to Samson's wife, "Entice your husband so that he will tell us the riddle, or we will burn you and your father's house with fire." Have you invited us to impoverish us? Well, that's just not very nice, is it? That certainly does not seem to be in the spirit of a wedding celebration. But this is the nature of man. We see here that these men are guilty of several sins. They're so committed to coming out on top that they are willing to cheat to get there. They're willing to force someone who had nothing to do with their wager into a very difficult position. They seem to make the assumption that the wife was in on a plot with Samson to ruin them, which was clearly untrue. Most chillingly, they were willing to threaten murder to get what they wanted. That's essentially what they're saying. We're going to destroy you and your father, your whole household, if we don't get what we want. Well, that seems a little bit over the top, considering that they were each only going to be out a change of clothes. But as we know, a competition with a lot on the line brings out the worst in men. And that brings us to verses 15 through 18, or 16 through 18. And again, these have been read for us. Samson's wife is understandably upset by this turn of events. She is too afraid for her family's safety to reveal the threat to her husband. After all, she hardly knows Samson. So she sets herself to getting the answer out of him by hook or by crook. She doesn't say, "Hey, you know, this is the threat and this is the situation." She instead wants to wheedle this information out of him. How she thinks that they will survive paying off the wager, you know, I don't know, but I guess it looked better than the alternative. Samson's wife plays all the manipulative notes that we might expect from a fleshly woman. There is emotional blackmail. "Don't you really love me?" There are the wild charges. There's constant nagging. Samson's defense of his silence is perfectly justified. The wife wasn't being singled out. He hadn't even told his own parents the answer to his riddle. It's not like she was being excluded. It was important to keep such things private. A secret. But the tearful assault continued. This note that the wife wept for the whole 7 days of the festivities need not contradict verse 15. This woman might have been after Samson for the answer even before the men came to her. Another solution that seems possible to me is that the bachelor's feast was held previous to the couple's feast. Samson never says that they have 7 days from the time he gives the riddle. They have to give the answer during the 7 days of the feast, which could be the coming one for the couple. I didn't read that anywhere, So I'm tentative about it, but that's one way I can reconcile this. Anyway, wow, you know, we all know what it's like when the wife, the woman that we love, starts to cry, right, guys? That's a tough one to deal with. You know, when all else fails, ladies just start crying. Samson finally gives in and tells her the answer, which quickly makes its way to the 30 men. And there's something inside of you that just really does not like that. In the nick of time, they present the answer. And again, they put it in poetic form. Samson realizes immediately what has happened. He knows this is the only way that they could have come upon the answer. And he speaks of her as his heifer. Okay, perhaps not the most flattering description. According to one of my commentaries, this reference to his wife as a heifer is meant to sum up not anything about her physically, but the untamed and stubborn spirit that she has displayed. Well, Samson's now in a pickle. He has to come through on his wager. How will he do it? Well, we find out in verses 19 and 20. Ashkelon was another Philistine city. It was about 24 miles away from Timnah. It's interesting that the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Samson before he goes there to Ashkelon. This leads us to try to figure out what role the Lord plays and what part Samson plays in the solution that he comes up with. God clearly enables Samson to do what he did. God clearly wanted him to do what he did in the larger context of his purposes. Could we still call the 30 men in Ashkelon innocent and therefore their death murder? I have a hard time accepting that. Considering the lack of information here about the 30 men and the circumstances of their death, I assume that this killing was legitimate in some way that's not explained for us. It had been clarified before he was born that Samson was a chosen instrument by which the Philistines would be afflicted. God is now enabling and guiding Samson to fulfill that call. I don't think of it was in any kind of arbitrary situation as far as who these 30 men in Ashkelon were. Samson's anger did burn, we read. Some point out that this appears after the killing and assert that it was directed at his wife, not at the Philistines. It's hard for me to believe, however, that Samson did not have hard feelings toward the Philistines for their role in coercing his wife. But I would say that it is definitely possible that the wrath that he had was justifiable, that the deaths were justifiable given the injustice that was done. And there may be more to the story and what these 30 others in Ashkelon had been involved with. But in any case, Samson does live up to his word and his part of the bargain in a very unexpected way. He does not return to his wife, however, but he goes back to his parents' house. Did he need time to cool off? Again, not sure about all of the meaning behind the details, but the father of the bride makes the assumption that the marriage is therefore off. And therefore, to save face, he gives his daughter to the best man. You couldn't make up anything better than this mess. I mean, this is just off the charts. Terrible and weird and everything. As we will see, that father made a wrong assumption. He only furthered the trouble that the Philistines were getting into with Samson by doing that. So we'll see where that goes. The saga will continue. Well, I think we should get into some application here. What I have for you are four quick thoughts rather than one or two big ones. And with the first one of these, the application also shades into some harmonization. We don't always have that aspect in a given message, but I think we definitely see again here the sovereignty of God in action. Sovereignty of God at work through what these men and even the sinful ones do. This marriage was highly questionable in the first place, as we discussed last time, but it was the forum for a series of offenses that God will use for his purposes. We have this riddle. I mean, what is the basis for the riddle that ends up becoming so central? Well, it was the Lord bringing this lion against Samson, enabling him to kill it, you know, bringing the bees to the carcass, bring Samson back to the carcass, you know, to see the honey and being inspired by all of this to create the riddle. And this is all of God again, not happenstance. God oversaw the sins of the companions, of Samson's wife, of her father, no doubt. Samson's as well. Even the wager seems tied to God's purposes. God clearly wanted these 30 Philistines killed. All of these things served to bring about grievances that Samson would subsequently address in an emphatic manner. The Lord is providing the motivations for Samson to fulfill his destiny as a deliverer of Israel from the Philistine yoke. Now, we could say that perhaps Samson could have been used through making better decisions. I'm very open to that thought. But verse 4 from last time is still testimony to God's desire to work through this relationship. And we could almost say at this point, through the lack of relationship with this woman, to further his purposes for his people. My second thought involves the depravity of man. The depravity of man. You get a really good dose of that in the book of Judges. And here we see it in particular. And I especially have the young men in mind here as we think about this. We can imagine that until Samson gave his riddle, and they began to have difficulty with that, that the atmosphere at this feast was a joyful one, a celebratory one, you know, camaraderie. Hey, you know, you're getting married and all of that. Everything, you know, look, on the surface, you would have looked at it and just said, this is just a great time with a bunch of guys having a feast. But one unexpectedly difficult puzzle changed everything about that scene. Scratch the surface of unregenerate man just a little, and what do you find? Pure wickedness is what you find. Suddenly, it became clear to these men what was at stake in their possessions and their pride, and they were willing to do whatever it took to preserve those things. Just like that. And that's the way man is. And we must never forget that. Never be fooled by the surface behavior of the unbeliever. Never think that, well, he's basically just like you. Never think that he or she cares about what you care about. All it takes is the right set of circumstances for self-preservation to kick in. The right circumstances in which the idols of that person's heart are threatened and the evil will come pouring out of the unsaved. You don't think that the Holocaust and worse can happen again? It can. It's on its way to happening again. Because that's the way man is. All of a sudden, the Germans and the Austrians and whoever, they just really didn't know. And it was really just a few, very evil, high-level people. And you can forget all that. Societies are absolutely able at any moment to turn to the most evil behavior. Don't think it's not true. Don't think that you're safe from what unbelievers around you, and it's mostly all unbelievers around us, what they would be happy to do to us. What I'm saying is that, as Jesus instructed us, we ought to be harmless as doves, but let's be wise as serpents as well in our evaluations. Jesus loved all men in the sense of doing what was right by all men at all times. That he did not entrust himself to men. Why? Because he knew what was in man. Know what's in man. You see it right here. A third thought is that we can see how easily and quickly marriage can become a nightmare when God's principles for it are not followed. Satan wants to poison our marriages. He wanted that from the very start and accomplished his ends from his, viewpoint very well with Adam and Eve. Here we see the same things happening. Samson marries a pagan, okay. Blunder. Then this heifer, as she is called, uses every sinful trick in the book to get him to do what she wants. This is hardly the model of a godly appeal to authority here. And instead of correcting his wife's approach, Samson teaches her that sin pays off by giving in to the nagging. He'd rather just get this off his back than actually address it in a righteous way. Well, this gets played out again and again and again. A father, a husband, gets presented with things that are wrong. Why can't we do this? Why don't we do this? Etc. And instead of addressing it as the spiritual leader of the home, eventually just gives in or gets angry because, not really for God's glory, but because his own comfort is being disturbed. This is a harbinger of things to come for Samson, isn't it? I mean, this is just, you know, a practice round for, you know, what you know is coming in this book. A nagging wife giving up a secret that then results in harm. We can certainly see where this kind of, you know, disorder in the family leads. There's no mutual respect and trust being established here in this relationship. This can't go anywhere good. What a contrast do we have between what we see developing here and what we saw with Samson's own parents. He certainly has not learned from them. When there's no concern for doing things God's way, you end up with a husband back at his parents' house and the wife off with somebody else. Finally, we have the biblical teaching on revenge supported and applied here in a narrative section. We're constantly told that vengeance is the Lord's, you know, that He will repay evil in His way and His time. It's not for us to decide how someone needs to be taught a lesson. For years, the Philistines had their way with the Jews. But now, in response to that confession and that putting away of idols that we saw back in chapter 10, God is punishing the oppressor. He is coming in His own time, in His own way, to bring vengeance upon these people. It was prophesied of Samson that he would do this avenging work. He was the person, the instrument that God was going to use. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him here to come against the Philistines. God is repaying. I don't think that this should be seen as simply an act of carnal vengeance. The Lord is using Samson as His instrument. It's very plain here. So we have no cause from this passage to think that, well, we should just take vengeance as we please, that God needs that help. No, the Lord might use us as we go about our business that He's given us faithful. He might use us to confound the enemy, but that is never to be our focus. It's never to be our plan. Well, let's take these things before the Lord and ask Him to bless our application.